clear certain thresholds, usually in comparison with the competition. This is very important. A big move is not big because it's hard or because the team feels stretched. It's big when it's big relative to your competition. Who knew that whether you were in the top half or bottom half of your industry in terms of R&D spending made a 15 percentage point difference in your chances of making it to the top quintile of the power curve? But it does. How many times have we seen companies shoot for a 2% gain in productivity, not thinking about how that moves them, or doesn't move them, against the competition? Who knew how important it was to make as many of the five moves as possible, rather than concentrate on one area for improvement, or how rare multiple moves actually are? Is that all? The idea that just 10 attributes can determine the odds can feel less than intuitive, even disconcerting. Surely, we are asked, other variables matter, such as talent, leadership, culture, and the deeper details of execution. There is an incomplete empirical research to suggest that they would, yet even without being able to separate these factors out, we can offer a huge improvement over what companies do today when they mostly hope that their strategies will work. Obviously, the more than 80% accuracy of the model implicitly includes these other levers, because the model is built on the full empirical evidence of how companies move on the power curve. The other factors, such as talent and leadership, have simply not been broken out separately. We are currently working on ways to more explicitly measure talent and incorporate it into probability estimates. For the moment, we look at the issue this way. No matter the quality of the talent base, if the strategy does not pass the thresholds of the 10 levers, it will be hard for talent to compensate for the weakness in endowment, trends, or moves. We also looked at industry-specific power curves. While they are similar, their exact shape can differ. The odds will vary, too, to some extent. We have seen the average odds of making it from the middle quintiles to the top vary from 5 to 16% in some of the industries that we looked at in more detail. And true, in some industries, M&A is simply not a realistic option, if a sector is already consolidated, if there are regulatory barriers, etc. We are now approaching even larger datasets with machine learning technology to see whether we can achieve another breakthrough. So, more work remains for us and for you. What's relevant for you and your business is that you can now know ahead of time your chances of succeeding with your strategy. You can know those odds precisely enough to act and see what levers matter to your own business. Because all the attributes can be measured and compared for a large sample of companies, our endowment plus trends plus moves model provides a true outside view of your probabilities. What makes this a powerful tool in your hand when battling the effects of the social side of strategy is that you now have a benchmark for the quality of a strategy that's independent from subjective judgments in the strategy room. You now have an external reference point to help calibrate the likelihood of success for your strategy, and with that, a tool to change the conversation among your team. Had such an outside view been a part of the strategy discussions at DNP or other companies with meaningful odds of dropping to the bottom quintile, those involved likely would have acted differently. When we showed the power curve to an insurance company in the U.S. that was close to the top of all companies, the benchmark startled the CEO. He said, "What on earth does that mean? Do I need to work hard just to stay there? Is there an upside left? Or can I change my industry to shift the entire curve?" He turned to his team and asked, "Did you know this? Are you giving me strategies that will move us up on this curve? Who of you is in a business that will help me move the company?" The strategy for that company changed right then and there. Of course, strategies live off genuine insights and new ideas. Strategy is an art. So while you can't do much about your endowment, we'll explore in the next two chapters how you can apply some of your insights, ideas, and art to both your trends and, in particular, your moves to increase as much as possible your odds of success. You'll need to sharpen your ability to predict trends and the future moves of your competitors. A good strategy is still hard to shape, but you can at least greatly increase your chances of understanding how close it is to a likely winner. We'll now dive deeper into the roles of trends and moves, the attributes you can actually influence. Chapter 6. The Writing is on the Wall. Seeing the writing on the wall is easy, but acting on it can be tough. To friend the trend, you must overcome myopia, pain avoidance, and inertia. If you want to understand how important it is to get trends right, ask Cor Boonstra, former CEO of Royal Philips. He spotted a crucial one at his PolyGram unit in the late 1990s and had the courage to act on it. PolyGram was one of the world's top record labels, with a roster boasting Bob Marley, U2, and top classical artists. But Boonstra flew to New York in 1998 to meet with Goldman Sachs and sell PolyGram to Seagram for $10.6 billion. Why? Because Boonstra had seen proprietary research conducted by Philips' own optical storage business, showing that consumers were largely using the new recordable CD-ROM technology, which Philips co-invented, for one purpose: to copy music. The MP3 format had barely been invented, Napster was a mere gleam in Sean Parker's eye, and PolyGram was at the top of its game. But Boonstra saw the first signs of transformation and acted decisively. Within a decade, compact disc and DVD sales in the U.S. dropped by more than 80%. How well did Boonstra time the sale? He nailed it. Just look at Exhibit 20, which shows that CD-DVD revenue was at its absolute peak when the PolyGram sale went through. It's safe to say that most of us don't do so well in timing markets. We see trends all the time and are comfortable talking about them. What's happening in the economy, new technology innovations, what's happening in our industry, new styles of apparel. What's the matter with kids today, you name it. But ask yourself, how often do we underestimate the importance of trends, the context in which we operate, because we are accustomed to believing that we are in control? How often do we see trends, but do not act fast enough on them? Almost every strategy process pays at least some credence to trends. Boards often invite industry experts to explain their visions of the future. Or maybe your CEO visited Silicon Valley and returned inspired by the tales of innovation and technology-induced fortunes, agility, and genes culture fantasy headquarters. Almost inevitably, ideas about blockchains, clouds, and hyperloops will seep into the strategy room, with grand visions of life a few decades from now. In many cases, strategy teams will dutifully toil and prepare industry analyses to tick the box. Yep, we understand the trends. Next. But more often than not, companies don't build the capabilities or lay out the specific actions to capitalize on the trends. They rarely translate trends into practical, investable pockets and decisively shift resources to capture the opportunities. One of our clients got the organization to take trends seriously, but it required a real jolt. After the three of us wrote an article for the McKinsey Quarterly in 2011 about the 10 timeless tests of strategy, that client, a large-scale global oil company, used the 10 tests as a challenge. The board requested each business unit to prepare a brief strategy presentation focusing on the most important choices they faced. These were given to the board, who scored each presentation using the 10 tests. The biggest discussions ensued consistently around test number 4, does your strategy put you ahead of trends? As a result, the company reoriented its growth portfolio to much more explicitly invest in suitable business opportunities around the trends and microtrends they prioritized. The gains were significant. A very different conversation about strategy. The full mechanics, while crucial in implementation, aren't all that important here. All that's needed is to understand the outline of the levers and to see how they can lead to a very different conversation about strategy, grounded in an outside view that is far more productive than the traditional inside view that holds in the strategy room. Again, we're not promising a crystal ball. Even if you were PCC and had a 76% chance of making it to the top quintile, that doesn't mean you'd have a guarantee to get there. We naturally saw some companies that moved in ways that the model didn't suggest. A peer of PCC in the aerospace and defense industry provides a cautionary tale. It was in a growth industry, had an enviable endowment, and made apparently strong moves. The company had a 72% probability of lifting from the middle to the top quintile of the power curve over the decade we studied. Instead, it went from a $70 million economic profit to a $780 million loss, and it slid to the tail of the power curve. While the company made moves, it made ones with a lower probability of success and executed some poorly and copped the wrong roll of the dice. A large-scale M&A strategy dramatically increased its debt without delivering returns. Low operating discipline in key aerospace and defense programs was marked by time and cost overruns. Some externalities also played a role, like lower-than-anticipated order volumes for a major product. Although a turnaround effort has improved profitability and reduced debt, the company provides a timely reminder that industry tailwinds and a strong endowment are not always enough. On the other hand, during the decade in question, the U.S.-based hotel chain Starwood Hotels and Resorts rose to the top of the power curve against the odds. In an industry with a strong headwind, and while holding significant debt, Starwood went from generating $306 million in economic profit in 2000 to 2004 to generating $332 million a decade later, outperforming the industry average of $182 million in 2010 to 2014. Its success was driven by a counterintuitive approach to a big move, portfolio rationalization. In this decade, Starwood made one acquisition, Le Méridien, and an astonishing 51 divestitures, including the sale of specific Sheraton and W luxury properties. This programmatic approach to M&A and divestitures supported a fundamental change in Starwood's operating model, shifting toward a brand-driven and capital-light hotel marketer and operator as opposed to a property owner. Management capitalized on Starwood's strengths, recognized the imminent headwinds and heavy debt obligations, and made a big move to beat the odds. Despite the experience of these despite-the-odds examples and others, our model's ability to explain 80 to 90% of the probability of movement along the power curve proves its merit. The exceptions often just serve to reinforce the rules. And while as humans we love heroic underdogs, and perhaps equally but less virtuously love it when big shots fail, as an investor or manager, it's always smarter to go with the odds. Tennis or badminton? If you're going to play a racket sport, you'd be wise to emulate tennis's Roger Federer, not badminton champion Lin Dan. Both are remarkably successful, perhaps the best ever in their games. Both are extremely marketable, with competitive instincts and personal charm. Yet no one asks, why doesn't Roger play badminton? They may indeed ask, who is Lin Dan? One of the reasons: a top 10 tennis player makes 10 to 20 times more than a top 10 player in any other racket sport. No matter how great a badminton player Lin Dan is, he won't win against his industry disadvantage. You too need to give yourself the biggest trend advantages that you can. As we've explained, the two that we've identified as most important, i.e., which way your industry and your geographies are moving, account for 25% of your odds of moving up or down on the power curve. Trends are the ground moving beneath your feet. They will move you up or down even before you make any other strategic moves yourself. Getting ahead of trends is easily the single most important strategic choice you have to make. Driven by the intensity of most businesses, many tend to focus on the immediate competition, but don't think much about the broader reasons for why they are moving. Maybe your gains result from your industry, not from anything particular you're doing. You might be an express courier while e-commerce is booming. Or you operate aged care facilities while the population is getting older. Maybe you're not so fortunate. Maybe you're a television broadcaster and your audience is moving to streamed video. Industries are escalators. Some of you may remember as children trying to beat your parents up the escalator by running up the one going down. You had to run so fast just to keep up with them floating up. Well, industries are like that. Either heading up and accelerating your progress, stuck on stop mode so it's only your effort that counts, or on a downward track, meaning you have to work hard just to stay where you are, let alone get ahead. Of the 117 companies that jumped from the middle quintiles to the top, 85 moved with their industry, which rose at least one quintile. Only 32 moved up against a downward industry trend, a drop of at least one quintile, proving that it is possible. Of the 201 that fell from the middle quintiles to the bottom, 157 were pulled down by their industry. A firm in a top quintile industry is 5 times more likely to be in the top quintile for all individual companies than one from a bottom quintile industry. Exhibit 21. So it's crucial to both identify all your relevant trends and to act on them in the right time frame. You have to make the trend your friend. As the global economy moves through cycles, as new technologies and business models emerge and older ones die, as industry structures change and new ecosystems are formed, profit pools shrink and grow and also move between industries. The results can sometimes be dramatic, requiring major action. Exhibit 22. For instance, the wireless telecom industry jumped from near the bottom of the curve 10 years ago to nearly to the top. The oil and gas industry, with the recent drop in commodity prices, went the other way in our ranking of 127 industries. Overall, the result resembles the movement among companies. Of 127 industries, 9% moved from the 3 middle quintiles up the industry power curve to the top over a decade. If you find yourself with a favorable industry trend, which, as we've said, is the single most important contributor to favorable odds, then you should ride that trend as hard as you can. If, however, you find yourself with an unfavorable industry trend, you might need to seriously consider changing your industry. Or changing industries. Change your industry or change industries. If you find yourself facing a disruption of the scale that Kodak did with digital photography, you have only 2 options. Either transform your industry, e.g. through consolidation to change its fundamental performance prospects, or decide to leave your industry to establish a new foothold in a less threatened space. Unfortunately, neither is easy. After we presented our data at a European utility conference, 3 executives came up to us and said they were shocked about where their industry was located on the power curve. The data made it painfully clear to them that the power curve is highly relevant even for personal career choices, requiring people to be conscious about the position of an industry on the power curve and the trends that industry could expect to see. Now, changing one's industry doesn't happen overnight, and the social side makes adapting even harder. Rarely is a business free to move from industry to industry just as the occasion demands. Private equity players and venture capitalists are a notable exception. For anybody operating a company, industry-changing moves are hard. But for some of you, they might be necessary. If you're going to stay in the same industry, you might need to try finding ways to alter the dynamics of your industry to sustainably boost performance. For instance, in the beer industry in Australia, which was just a so-so performer decades ago, Lion and Foster consolidated it so thoroughly in the 1980s and 1990s that the industry became a lot more attractive for both. LAN Airways drove a new business model for airlines in South America, and did extremely well. Buurtzorg Nederland has changed the home healthcare industry in the Netherlands and created an economic and social success story with a profoundly new and humane delivery model. What all of these have in common is that they made big, innovative moves and committed their entire companies to changing the game. They all executed strategies that dramatically altered the bases of competition in their industries and positioned themselves to capitalize on those changes. If you can't rewrite the rules of your industry, you might have to reposition your portfolio toward new growth businesses. Strong reallocators move more than 50% of their capital base to new industries over a 10-year period. Building the confidence to do so, hiring the right talent, and acquiring the necessary capabilities are tough mountains to climb. For many, in the face of overwhelmingly small odds to succeed in their current industries, finding those new opportunities might be the only way to improve the odds of having a bright future. Nearly 25% of the companies in our database managed to shift more than half of their capital investment over the course of a decade. Another 30% of companies shifted more than one-fifth. How did they do it? As we've said, one crucial piece is to shake free of the notion that the status quo is the baseline. Just keeping up is hard these days. The power curve is steep, and is getting steeper over time. Competitors are not sleeping. So you have to throw out the notion that your industry is benign and open the windows of the strategy room to a clear-eyed, cold-hearted outside view. Consider changing locations, too. Although geography doesn't matter quite as much as industry, it still matters. You should assess the geographies where you operate and market your products or services for their growth potential and trends. As you can easily imagine, having exposure to high-growth geographies can also be an important factor in generating profitable growth. In general, having a granular perspective on where growth occurs is very important. A major computer manufacturer, for example, took granularity to an extraordinary degree in China. They looked at 680 major cities grouped in 21 clusters and prioritized cities, malls, and store locations within these malls for optimizing the return on their growth investments. Just by reallocating sales and marketing spending, the company accelerated growth by 50%. Random question. Do you know Tianjin, Chengdu, Chongqing? No? Chongqing is a city in western China with more than 30 million citizens, some of whom, more likely than not, assembled your personal inkjet laser printer. If you don't know these cities, you probably also do not realize that more than 50% of global GDP growth over the next decade could be produced by 230 Chinese cities. Over-indexing on exposure to fast-growing markets can create the obvious upside for your company's growth performance. We found that businesses headquartered in emerging markets not only benefited from growth trends in emerging markets, but also delivered stronger growth performance in developed markets. That may just be a curious side point, but underscores the importance of not just focusing on your home markets. In 2012, the newly appointed CEO of Philips, Franz von Houten, launched an initiative to make China a second home market for the company, which resulted in accelerated growth and substantially strengthened competitiveness, especially against local competitors in China. Even beyond the specific insights you get by understanding the relative ranking and prospects for various industries and geographies, looking at trends starts to change the dialogue in the strategy room. No longer does all credit accrue to management and all blame go to external factors that couldn't have been controlled. Now you can actually see how much of your company's movement along the power curve stems from factors related to your industry and geographies, and how much comes from what you and your colleagues achieved relative to the changing of the water level. You've brought a fresh, evidence-based perspective into the conversation that can help reframe the discussion. Go micro. The crucial insight isn't always about megatrends or major disruption either. One of the biggest challenges to acting on trends is the daily grind of serving your customers and responding to their needs in a timely manner. Success over the long term might simply be the accumulation of accurately understanding trends within your industry, making sure you have the flexibility to adapt and channel your resources to the best opportunities accordingly, and doing so faster than your competition. It's picking the right geographies, the right customer segments, the right micro-segments, and reallocating resources within your current business to capitalize on differentiated growth prospects and trends. One of our authors, Sven Smit, who co-authored Granularity of Growth a decade ago, showed that 80% of the variance in growth performance of companies is explained by the choices of the markets they operate in and M&A. The PC company operating in China mentioned previously did exactly that, and executed an extremely granular approach to allocating resources ahead of growth trends. Sir Martin Sorrell, CEO of marketing conglomerate WPP, describes how important it is to chase the opportunities within your industry. A major reason why we've grown is that we've tried to focus on where the growth areas are. At the moment, if your business is located in Asia and the Pacific, you're going to grow faster than if it's located in Western Europe. We try to identify growth trends in our industry, and our continued growth rate will be dependent on that. It will also obviously be dependent on finding the best acquisitions, but primarily, it will be pushing on open doors. It doesn't matter how clever you are, if you're pushing on a closed door, it's much more difficult. Given the importance of industry position and trends, companies that best catch the waves build these perspectives into the day-to-day arsenal of how their management team looks at performance. Rather than using sporadic deep dives, often based on internal accounting data and standard market reports, you can use comprehensive analytics suites to deliver within days what was impossible to do in months just a few years ago. You can have industry-level performance comparisons and disaggregations, portfolio benchmarks, growth MRIs, etc., all the way to investor analytics. The need for privileged insights. To differentiate, you need privileged insights. These come from moving from high-level trends all the way down to investable pockets, specific and addressable business opportunities. Sometimes developing the privileged insights requires investing in proprietary data. For decades, B2C companies have invested in loyalty programs, such as airline miles or retail store cards, which often provide a price discount in return for customer data. Those data allow them to derive deeper monetizable insights. Supermarkets are now able to segment customers by several dimensions at a time, e.g., geography, demography, basket size, shop frequency, promotion participation, premium product mix, etc. We're no longer talking about 8 segments, we're talking about thousands. Supermarkets can now personalize their marketing campaigns, can tailor range by store, can understand which categories are more or less price sensitive, can see which brands carry more loyalty, can conduct A/B testing on online channels, and so on. So, while the macro trend might say retail is shifting toward online, it's the granular view of the customer and investable pockets that makes the shift effective. You can also collide macro and micro insights to identify which trends are real and which are just hype or fads. In 2010, incumbent wooden shipping pallet supplier CHEP was under threat from the adoption of plastic RFID-enabled pallets that were aggressively marketed by disruptor IGPS. Investors saw a macro trend that would mark the end of wooden pallets and encouraged CHEP to make a major investment in plastic to replace the existing pool. CHEP's micro insight was built on a detailed understanding of which customers were switching and why. CHEP recognized the underlying trend that had opened the door for the plastic threat, increased use of automation in FMCG manufacturing processes meant pallets needed to fit stricter dimensional criteria. CHEP saw that plastic was suitable for only a niche set of customers and economically unfeasible for large scale based on a much higher capital cost for plastic versus wood. Instead of replacing its existing $2 billion capital base and using a more expensive plastic option, CHEP responded to the underlying customer need and invested in stricter quality and repair processes. CHEP also used a dispatch algorithm that made sure that those customers that depended on the highest quality pallets had access to them. CHEP's margin suffered slightly, IGPS went bankrupt after losing several vital customers, including PepsiCo, and was eventually picked up by a private equity firm. Acting on the writing on the wall. Having established just how important it is to get ahead of trends, we now hit the biggest snag of them all. It is often the very same things that make companies successful that also make it hard for them to act on trends. Incumbency can make it difficult to deal with disruptions. Industry leadership can make it hard to act on the writing on the wall, but not impossible. A decade ago, Norwegian media group Schibsted made a courageous decision to offer classifieds, the main revenue source for its newspaper businesses, online for free. The company had already made significant internet investments, but realized that to establish a pan-European digital stronghold, it had to raise the stakes. During a presentation to a prospective French partner, Schibsted executives pointed out that existing European classified sites had limited traffic. "The market is up for grabs," they said, "and we intend to get it." Today, over 80% of their earnings come from online classifieds. About that same time, the boards of other leading newspapers were also weighing the prospect of a digital future. No doubt, like Schibsted, they even developed and debated hypothetical scenarios in which internet startups siphoned off the lucrative print classified ads that the industry called its rivers of gold. Maybe these scenarios appeared insufficiently alarming, or maybe they were too dangerous to even entertain. But very few newspapers followed Schibsted's path. From the vantage point of today, when print media has been shattered by digital disruption, it's easy to talk about who made the right decision. Things are far murkier when one is actually in the midst of disruption's uncertain, oft-hyped early stages. In the 1980s, steel giants famously underestimated the potential of mini-mills. In the 1980s and 1990s, the personal computer put a big dent in Digital Equipment Corporation, Wang Laboratories, and other mini-computer makers. More recently, web retailers have disrupted physical ones, and Airbnb and Uber Technologies have disrupted lodging and car travel, respectively. The examples run the gamut from database software to boxed beef. What they have in common is how often incumbents find themselves on the wrong side of a big trend. No matter how strong their balance sheets and market share going in, and sometimes because of those very factors, incumbents can't seem to hold back the tide of disruptors. The good news is that many industries are still in the early days of disruption. Print media, travel, and lodging provide valuable illustrations of the path that increasingly more will follow. For most, it's early enough to respond. What's the secret of those incumbents that do survive, and sometimes even thrive? One aspect surely relates to the ability to recognize and overcome the typical pattern of response, or lack thereof, that characterizes companies in the incumbent's position. This most often requires foresight and a willingness to respond boldly before it's too late, which usually means acting before it's obvious you have to do so. As Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, pointed out, right as his company was making the leap from DVDs to streaming, most successful organizations fail to look for new things their customers want because they're afraid to hurt their core businesses. Companies rarely die from moving too fast, and they frequently die from moving too slowly, he said. We are all great strategists in hindsight. The question is what to do when you are in the middle of it all, under the real-world constraints and pressures of running a large modern company. From an incumbent's perspective, you have to navigate four stages of a disruptive trend. The four stages of a disruptive trend. It may help to view these stages on an S-curve, see Exhibit 23. At first, young companies struggle with uncertainty, but are agile and willing to experiment. At this time, companies prize learning and optionality and work toward creating equity value based on the expectation of future earnings. The new model then needs to reach some critical mass to become a going concern. As firms mature, that is, become incumbents, mindsets and realities change. The established companies lock in routines and processes. They iron out and standardize variability amid growing organizational complexity. In the quest for efficiency, they weed out strategic options and reward executives for steady results. The measure of success is now delivery of consistent growing cash flows in the here and now. The option-rich expectancy of future gain is replaced by the treadmill of continually escalating performance expectations. In a disruption, the company heading toward the top of the old S-curve confronts a new business model at the bottom of a new S-curve. Creative destruction turns another cycle, but this time the shoe is on the other foot. Two primary challenges emerge. For one, it can be hard to recognize the new S-curve, which starts with a small slope and often unimpressive profitability and does not catch your attention. Ray Kurzweil, the inventor, futurist, and investor, says it is difficult to recognize the early stages of exponential growth curves in the first place, as most processes in our lives evolve in a more linear manner. While most companies have shown they are very good at dealing with obvious emergencies by rapidly corralling resources and acting decisively, they struggle to deal with the slow, quiet rise of an uncertain threat that does not announce itself noisily. The second challenge is that the same factors that help companies operate strongly at the top of an S-curve often hinder them at the bottom of a new one. Different modes of operation are required, but it's sometimes hard to do the right thing, even when you think you know what the right thing might be. New S-curves rather often always require different skill sets to succeed. The value of experience is demoted. The simplified idea of a new S-curve crashing slow motion into an old one gives us a way to look at the problem from the incumbent's perspective and to appreciate the actual challenges each moment presents. In the first stage, the new S-curve is not yet a curve at all. In the second, the new business model gets validated, but its impact is not forceful enough to fundamentally bend the performance trajectory of the incumbent. In the third stage, the new model gains critical mass and its impact is clearly felt. In the fourth, the new model becomes the new normal as it reaches its own maturity. Stage 1. Signals amid the noise. We already talked about how disruption hit the music business. Similarly, Spark New Zealand foresaw the deteriorating economics of its Yellow Page business and sold its directories business in 2007 for $2.2 billion, a 9-time revenue multiple, while numerous other telecom companies held on until the businesses were nearly worthless. The newspaper industry had no shortage of similar signals. As early as 1964, media theorist Marshall McLuhan observed that the industry's reliance on classified ads and stock market quotes made it vulnerable. Should an alternative source of easy access to such diverse daily information be found, the press will fold. The rise of the Internet created just such a source, and startups like eBay opened a new way for people to list goods for sale without the use of newspaper ads. Yet Schibsted's big move to adapt in 1999 was one of the few early actions by a media company. It's not surprising that most other publishers didn't react. At this early stage of disruption, incumbents feel barely any impact on their core businesses except in the distant periphery. They don't need to act. It takes rare acuity to make a preemptive move, likely in the face of conflicting demands from stakeholders. What's more, it can be difficult to work out which trends to ignore and which to react to. Denial can open doors for new entrants. Aldi's successful entry into the Australian grocery market against an incumbent duopoly was in part enabled by the incumbent's unwillingness to acknowledge just how attractive the Aldi proposition would be to the Australian consumer. In the early days, the impact was so small, too small to push competitors into a defensive position that would sacrifice margin. You would hear language about managing threats, but the actions suggested denial. 16 years later, Aldi commands market share of approximately 13% in Australia, which it continues to grow as it expands its store footprint. Gaining sharper insight and escaping the myopia of this first stage requires incumbents to challenge their own story and to disrupt long-standing and sometimes implicit beliefs about how to make money in a given industry. As our colleagues put it in a recent article, these governing beliefs reflect widely shared notions about customer preferences, the role of technology, regulation, cost drivers, and the basis of competition and differentiation. They are often considered inviolable until someone comes along to violate them. The process of reframing these governing beliefs involves identifying an industry's foremost notion about value creation and then turning it on its head to find new forms and mechanisms for creating value. The social side of strategy will, as usual, complicate the reframing. People have become accustomed to the old way of thinking, and changing mindsets is hard. Many also have businesses that are making a lot of money based on the old S-curve, and in the battle for resources, might, at least quietly, stem attempts to shift toward a new one. The traditionalists' arguments will be especially persuasive in the early stages before the attractiveness of the transition becomes clear. As personal computer pioneer Alan Kay used to say, "Everybody likes change, except for the change part." Stage 2. Change takes hold. The trend is now clear. The core technological and economic drivers have been validated. At this point, it's essential for established companies to commit to nurturing new initiatives so that they can establish footholds in the new sphere. More important, they need to ensure that new ventures have autonomy from the core business, even if the goals of the two operations conflict. The idea is to act before one has to. But with disruption's impact still not big enough to dampen earnings momentum, motivation is often missing. Even as online classifieds for cars and real estate began to take off and Craigslist gained momentum, most newspaper publishers lacked a sense of urgency because their own market shares remained largely unaffected. And it's not like the new players were making millions, yet. There was no performance envy. But Shibsted did find the necessary motivation. When the dot-com bubble burst, we continued to invest in spite of the fact that we didn't know how we were going to make money online, recalls CEO Shel Aumont. We also allowed the new products to compete with the old products. Offering free online classifieds directly cannibalized its newspaper business, but Shibsted was willing to take the risk. The company didn't just act, it acted radically. Microsoft made a similarly radical shift after then-CEO Bill Gates took one of his think weeks in 1995 and realized that the company was greatly underestimating the importance of the Internet. He returned with his famous Internet memo and fundamentally reoriented the company, killing some projects, reallocating resources to others, and launching still more. Now, let's openly acknowledge how hard it is for a company's leaders to commit to supporting experimental ventures when the business is climbing the S-curve. Not many companies have a Bill Gates lying around. When Netflix disrupted itself in 2011 by shifting focus from DVDs to streaming, its share price dropped by 80%. Few boards and investors can handle that kind of pain when the near-term need is debatable. The vague longer-term threat just doesn't seem as dangerous as the immediate hardship. After all, incumbents have existing revenue streams to protect. Startups only have upside to capture. Additionally, management teams are more comfortable developing strategies for businesses they know how to operate and are naturally reluctant to enter a new game with rules they don't understand. In other words, the social side of strategy rules again. The upshot. Most incumbents dabble, making small investments that won't flatten their current S-curve and that guard against cannibalization. Usually, incumbents focus too heavily on finding synergies, always looking for efficiency, rather than fostering radical experimentation. The illusion that this dabbling is getting you into the game is all too tempting to believe. Many newspapers built online add-ons to their classified businesses, but few were willing to risk cannibalizing the traditional revenue streams, which at this point were still far bigger and more profitable. And remember, at this time, Schibsted had not yet been rewarded for its early action. Its results looked pretty similar to its peers. In time, of course, bolder action becomes necessary, and executives must commit to nurturing potentially dilutive and small next horizon businesses in a pipeline of initiatives. Managing such a portfolio requires high tolerance for ambiguity, and it requires executives to adapt to shifting conditions, both inside and outside the company, even as the aspiration to deliver favorable outcomes for shareholders remains constant. The difficulty is the tendency to protect the core because of short-term financial incentives and emotional ties that inhibit a shift to the periphery. No small part of the challenge is to accept that the previous status quo is no longer the baseline. The future success of grocery retailer Aldi's low price model was visible while Aldi was still nascent. Yet many incumbent supermarkets chose to avoid the near-term pain of sharpening entry price points and improving their private label brands. In hindsight, those moves cleared the way for Aldi's continued strong growth across three continents. Stage 3. The Inevitable Transformation. By now, the future is pounding on the door. The new model has proved superior to the old, at least for some critical mass of adopters, and the industry is in motion. At this stage of disruption, to accelerate its own transformation, the incumbent's challenge lies in aggressively shifting resources to the new, self-competing ventures it nurtured in Stage 2. Think of the change as treating new businesses like venture capital investments that only pay off if they scale rapidly, while the old ones are subject to a private equity-style workout. Making this tough shift requires overcoming the inertia that can afflict companies even in the best of times. As we've seen, the social side of strategy almost guarantees a peanut butter approach to allocating resources, making a sharp reorientation hard to pull off. The hardest stage. In fact, our experience suggests Stage 3 is the hardest one for incumbents to navigate. As company performance starts to suffer, tightening up budgets, established companies naturally tend to cut back even further on peripheral activities while focusing on the core. The top decision makers, who usually come from the biggest business centers, resist having their still profitable, though more sluggishly growing domains, starved of resources in favor of unproven upstarts. As a result, leadership often underinvests in new initiatives and imposes high performance hurdles on them. Legacy businesses continue to receive the lion's share of resources. By this time, the very forces causing pressure in the core make the business even less willing and able to address those forces. Under the influence of the social side of strategy, the reflex to conserve resources kicks in just when you most need to aggressively reallocate and invest. Boards play a significant role. Far too often, boards are unwilling or unable to change their view of baseline performance, further exacerbating the problem. Often, a board's understandable reaction to reduced performance is to push management even harder to achieve ambitious goals within the current model, ignoring the need for a more fundamental change. This only worsens problems in the future. Further complicating matters, incumbents with initially strong positions can take false comfort at this stage because the weaker players in the industry get hit hardest first. The narrative that it is not happening to us is all too tempting to believe. The key is to closely monitor the underlying drivers and not just use hindsight based on financial outcomes. The tale says, "I don't have to outrun the bear, I just have to outrun you." But when it comes to disruption, that strategy merely buys time. The bear will keep running, and it will get to you, too. Even when the course is reasonably clear, getting the team moving in a new direction can be hard. When an Asian high-tech manufacturer diversified into green energy, not a single member of the top team wanted to lead the business. The company brought in an outsider, but he was never able to marshal enough resources from the core business. The strategy was right, but the lack of a strong leader led to failure and a $10 million write-off just a few years later. Similarly, an Australian bank wanted to expand into Indonesia to catch the trend of consumer growth and digital there. Not a single member of the top team raised his or her hand when asked for volunteers to build this growth pillar. The company abandoned the plans right then and there. To generate the acceleration needed at this stage of the game, incumbents must embark on a courageous and unremitting reallocation of resources from the old to the new model and show a willingness to run new businesses differently and often separately from the old ones. Perhaps nothing underlines this point more than Axel Springer's 2013 divestment of some of its strongest legacy print media products, which accounted for about 15% of its sales, to Germany's number three print media player, Funke Mediengruppe. These products, such as the Berliner Morgenpost, owned by Axel Springer since 1959, were previously a core part of the corporate DNA and emblems of its journalistic culture. But no more. Axel Springer realized that the future value of the business was not just about continuation of today's earnings, but rather relied on the creation of a new economic engine. The German media company was a mere internet midget, according to Financial Times Deutschland, until it leaped into action in 2005. It went on a shopping spree, acquiring 67 digital properties and launching 90 initiatives of its own by 2013. Most important was choosing a new area to expand into, online classifieds, which were both high margin and high growth, and doubling down on it. The lesson from Axel Springer, like Schibsted, is that incumbents can win even with a late start, provided that they throw themselves in wholly. Today, over 80% of Axel Springer's EBITDA is derived from digital. When the incumbents lack the in-house capability to build new businesses, they must look to acquire them instead. Here the challenge is to time acquisition somewhere between where the business model is proved and where valuations become too high, all while making sure the incumbent is a natural best owner of the businesses it acquires. Examples of this approach in the financial sector include BBVA's acquisition of Simple and Capital One's acquisition of the design firm Adaptive Path. Stage 4. Adapting to the new normal. In this late stage, the disruption has reached a point where companies have no choice but to accept reality. The industry has fundamentally changed. For incumbents, their cost base isn't in line with the new, likely much shallower profit pools, their earnings are caving in, and they find themselves poorly positioned to take a strong market position. This is where print media is now. The classifieds' rivers of gold have dried up, making survival the first priority and growth the second. In 2013, the CEO of Australian media company Fairfax Media told the International News Media Association World Congress, "We know that at some time in the future we will be predominantly digital, or digital only in our metropolitan markets. True, some legacy mastheads have created powerful online news properties with high traffic, but display advertising and paywalls alone are for the most part not enough to generate a thriving revenue line, and social aggregation sites are continuing to drive unbundling. Typical media firms have had to undertake the multiple painful waves of restructuring and consolidation that may be needed while they seed growth and look for ways to monetize their brands. For the incumbents, that like Axel Springer and Schibsted have made the leap, the adaptation phase brings new challenges. They are now majority digital businesses, fully exposed to the volatility and pace that come with the territory. Rather than resting on their laurels, they adapt through continual self-disruption. Think of Facebook upending its business model in 2013 to go mobile first, or China's Tencent letting the mobile-based WeChat cannibalize its already dominant QQ desktop social media platform. You can't be satisfied with the first pivot. You have to be prepared to keep pivoting. In some cases, incumbents' capabilities are so highly tied to the old business model that rebirth through restructuring is unlikely to work, and an exit is the best way to preserve value. Eastman Kodak Company, for example, may have been better off leaving the photography business much faster, because its numerous strategies all failed to save it. When a business is built on a legacy technology that is categorically different from the new standard, even perfect foresight of the demise of film or CDs would not have solved the core problem that the digital replacement is fundamentally less profitable. The social side of strategy can again complicate the shift. Unlike Axel Springer, most find it hard to part with a business that is so identified with their history. When a very senior, proud, and successful executive has run a business for so long, it's hard for the CEO to pull resources away from them, even when the business is threatened. Boards and management teams find it hard to let go of old ideas, including assumptions about profitability. In many companies, there is nothing more sacred than the business they originally were built around. The challenge is to adapt and structurally realign cost bases to the new reality of profit pools and accept that the new normal likely includes far fewer rivers of gold. While getting trends right is hard, there is good news in the next chapter. We lay out what we found about the combinations of big moves that can also help you reposition your business ahead of trends. It's taken a bit of a journey, but we're now set up for the most consequential discussion. You now have an outside view that helps you benchmark your performance, think about your odds of achieving a significant success, and understand the endowment you began with and the trends that are affecting you. You can now ask the most important question. What are my big moves? Chapter 7. Making the Right Big Moves. 5 big moves make all the difference in shifting your odds. Big moves sound scary, but they are actually the safest bet. They are best done by purposefully making a series of smaller steps over time. On page 37 of the strategy discussion, you lost sight of what's important and what's not. You were listening to long lists of things that need to get done to grow market share, to win the next big account, to improve margin. At the outset of the discussion in the strategy room, you might have started talking about the big choices, but that was weeks earlier. Now you are buried in the detail of the first-year operating budget of your 5-year strategic plan. Everything is becoming incremental. Most of us have been ground down in a situation like that, and as our research shows, confirming what we've sensed all along, incremental doesn't get companies very far. In fact, incremental moves increase the risk of underperformance. To keep us away from incrementalism and focused on what matters, we'll describe in this chapter the 5 big moves that play by far the most significant role in determining your odds of success. The list is short, so you can keep the conversation in the strategy room focused on it, heading off those page 37 woes and giving yourself a shot at real success. You begin with your endowment, what you have been given based on your size, your debt level, and your investment in R&D. You also operate within the context of trends, which are also largely out of your control initially, but which you can influence by adapting your resource allocation to catch the right waves. But moves are where the action is. They're more within your control, the things you do. Moves put your money where your mouth is. Moves are collectively the strongest determinants of success. And that's empowering. So we'll go through the 5 big moves that we briefly outlined before. Programmatic M&A and divestitures, resource reallocation, capital expenditure, productivity improvement, and differentiation improvement. Every CEO has most or all of them on the to-do list. Who isn't interested in better productivity or investing in growth opportunities? However, it's important to keep in mind that the five big moves matter because they predict success more than any others, need to be pulled hard enough to make a difference to your odds of climbing the power curve,